Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about making zoodles and our first summer getaways this year. Plus, we'll have an interview with Jennifer McGruther, author of The Nourish Kitchen. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. Marisa.
Yes.
Did you see the new website, Extra Crispy?
I did. I got a chance to look at it when you sent me the link.
Extra Crispy is a new website dedicated entirely to the theme of breakfast.
I approve.
A worthy topic.
Yes, absolutely. I enjoy.
But what wasn't obvious to me at first glance was the fact that this website is a part of Time Inc., which is a big publishing company that publishes tons of magazines and other websites. But it's part of their marketing arm. It's produced by a department within Time Inc. called The Foundry, which is a branded content department.
Interesting.
That is, to me, interesting. So then when I looked at the content again with a second, a more informed eye, you know, I was wondering, like, how does that – I didn't know what to make of it. Like, is this content all sponsored? What parts of it are sponsored? Like, it made me just feel very – suspicious?
Yeah.
Is that the right word?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems obvious to me, like this next step seems obvious to me in the world of content and advertising that we're seeing right now, because, you know, it used to be that you had content and you had advertisements. And then as people have stopped, you know, used ad blockers or you're not subscribing to newspapers anymore, the advertising has gone in content, you know. So this just seems like the next obvious step.
But up until now, I think it's always been relatively easy to distinguish between paid content, sponsored content, and editorial content.
True.
I mean, I'm certainly I'm not an opponent of sponsored content. I think we all have to, you know, everybody has to get paid.
Yeah.
You know, we would sure be happy to find a sponsor for this podcast, for example. I'm always grateful to see a welcome advertorial in a magazine that corresponds to my interests. I just feel like you have to be upfront with your readers and listeners. And I just wonder, is that missing from this Extra Crispy?
Well, possibly, although maybe there's some value in being in a place in the world where the onus is on the advertisers to create such good content that it is indistinguishable from other kinds of content.
Well, what's your take? Are you just regarding the whole thing as an ad?
I didn't. And, you know, I looked at it at first sort of as a blank slate and thought, this is a really interesting website. But knowing now what I do, I do look at it as one giant ad.
Huh.
But if this is the way all advertisement is going, I'd rather have it be bringing value to the table rather than being sort of the thing that you sort of try to skip over or avoid.
Right. I just want to know when I'm being sold to, you know?
I think you should probably assume that most of the time in life you are being sold to.
That's probably a fair point.
So, you know, and it's, maybe the times you're not being sold to are going to become the unusual ones. I don't know.
Right.
Sort of sad.
It's sort of to me like the hubbub over GMO foods. Like, just label it. Just tell me what it is. Like,
yeah.
I want to know what I'm eating/reading, you know?
True.
Because there are just the forces of commerce on content can warp it, you know? And I trust consumers of media to work that out from themselves, but how can they do it without any signposts, you know?
Yeah.
That said, it is a really interesting site. Tons of great bylines there. A lot of good stories. I liked reading it. I just felt kind of a little silly when I
learned
after the fact that it was really like a branded content project. Anyway, we'll see where it goes. It's only at this point like one day old. So
yeah, it'll be interesting.
I think they launched with 50 odd stories.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
So Joy, I hear you are a fan of the zoodle.
I love making zoodles, which for the uninitiated are pasta-like strands of zucchini that you create with a special tool. I actually now have two tools for this. The ultimate tool is the spiralizer, which is like a large countertop contraption, with like a hand crank that you push your vegetables through with the crank and you get the vegetable
spiral
noodles. It's not just zucchini that you can put through the spiralizer. And I've never been able to justify the space for that, but you can also get like a small julienne peeler, mm-hmm. which is just the size of a vegetable peeler. That works pretty well. And then OXO somewhat recently introduced a tool that is kind of like a big pencil sharpener for vegetables almost. And you just put your zucchini in there and you turn it, and it really does make beautiful, easy zoodles.
Yeah.
So what do I do with my zoodles? Primarily, I do use them as a – I either just serve them entirely in place of spaghetti in like a pasta dish mm-hmm. or a noodle salad, or I do half and half noodles and zoodles, which actually tricks Dan into thinking it's all noodles somehow. But you're not a zoodler? You're not into it?
Well, I personally like zoodles. I, for years now, have been making a salad that Tara Austin Weaver put on her blog. She's a writer based in Seattle. Her blog is called Tea and Cookies. And I met her years and years ago through the whole Canvolution, canning mm-hmm. across America thing. And I went to a potluck once out in Seattle, and she brought the salad. And so I adopted it. And so it's spiralized or zucchini noodles with dried cherry tomatoes and pesto and toasted nuts.
Oh, that sounds terrific.
Really, really, really good. I mean, it's basically like pesto pasta, mm-hmm. only you're using the zucchini noodles instead.
And I'm assuming they're cold.
They're cold.
Right.
They're raw. And it is so good. And it's one of these things that it's really easy to eat a lot of zucchini when you're mm-hmm. eating it topped with pesto and with sun-dried tomatoes mm-hmm. or, you know, dehydrated tomatoes. So it's one that I really love. Zucchini is on the banned foods list for my husband.
Oh, no.
And so I will confess to have snuck it into things at times, but in a pureed state. I don't think I could get a zucchini noodle past him.
Huh. If you mix it half and half with regular noodles.
Maybe. We'll see. I do actually have a spiralizer that I got as a review sample mm-hmm. A couple years ago. And I like it, but it's up on a top shelf, and so right. I don't take it down often.
Not much to you if you can't get yeah. the person that you're eating with to eat zoodles. And certainly, people like to spiralize all kinds of things. Sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
What else? Beets.
I really like doing it with cucumber and making a salad out of them, like a quick pickled cucumber.
I haven't even thought about spiralizing cucumbers. It seems like they'd be too watery.
Well, what I do is you want to do like an English cucumber, not one mm-hmm. of the sort of watery slicers, and then salt it and drain it.
Gotcha.
So, you know, do it and then salt it and then drain it and then turn it into like a, you know, I like to do it with toasted sesame oil and rice wine vinegar and a little bit of slivered red onion. And it makes for just a really crunchy, tangy, satisfying little quick pickle salad kind of thing.
That's cool. My two favorite things to put on top of zoodles are just marinara sauce with my chicken meatballs on top.
Mm-hmm.
Or I like to do an Asian peanut sauce with sometimes some chicken and herbs and sesame seeds on top of it.
That sounds really good.
And I eat so many zoodles in the summertime. And I've actually recently seen packaged zoodles at Whole Foods. Some, like, they zoodled them in the back.
Yeah.
And put them on styrofoam. And they're out in the produce section with the other pre-chopped vegetables.
I've seen that. I've seen pre-made zoodles. I've also seen pre-made cauliflower rice. Those are the two. I guess they've gotten trendy that yeah. people are buying them pre-made.
Yeah, I know the zoodles are trendy, but I think I'll always keep eating them because it is a really smart swap for pasta, especially in the summer. There's wall-to-wall zucchini.
Yeah.
So I think that that's something I'll probably keep doing, even as it goes out of style eventually.
Absolutely. I've been really curious about KitchenAid has a spiralizer attachment for KitchenAid mixers.
Really?
That I've almost pulled the trigger on a couple of times and then decided I already have a spiralizer. I don't need to buy a second one. But I'm intrigued by it because I feel like
that would... mechanized, I guess?
Yeah. And you don't have to crank anything or turn anything. So.
I like it. That's an interesting thought.
I think it'd be a fun one to use.
If I got that, it would be my third way to make zoodles.
But I do... I really like them. They're fun. The other fun thing about some of the spiralizers is it's not only just a julienne slice.
Mm-hmm.
There's some that do like wide flat noodles. So you can do sort of ribbons. You could do like a carrot ribbon salad and things like that.
Oh, you can do that pretty easily with your plain old vegetable peeler.
True enough. But
I like options.
And I like gadgets. So it comes together well.
Well, let's talk about our recent weekends away.
Yes.
Shall we?
Absolutely.
Tell me more about your weekend in Lancaster.
Yes. So for Memorial Day weekend, my husband Scott and I went to Lancaster County. And this is a trip we have taken many times before. It's sort of our default vacation spot when we want to be close to Philadelphia.
How far away is it?
Depending on where you go in sort of Lancaster County, or sometimes we sneak out into York County, it's anywhere from like an hour and 10 minutes to an hour and 45.
Okay.
So it's not that far. And it's a really great way from Philadelphia to feel like you are in another world without having to travel too far. And it's really affordable to go out there. You know, we rent a cabin, but hotel options are mm-hmm. abundant and inexpensive. There are lots of great little bed and breakfasts. And it's just a really pleasing getaway because life, you know, I live in the middle of Center City, Philadelphia. So being any place where there's a babbling brook going by a cabin, or you're on the edge of someone's farm, or we've rented cabins that are sort of in little parks, but are sort of cabins from the 1700s. And so it's a very delightful way to really get a break from the city for me.
Did your cabin have a kitchen?
It did. So and this,
did you cook in it or did you eat out?
We did a combination of cooking and eating out. So anytime we're in Lancaster County, Scott insists we go to Shady Maple at least once, which is the sort of premier smorgasbord in Lancaster.
Speaking of which, did you see local Philadelphia writer Caroline Russick wrote a big story about sort of the food culture of Lancaster, including Shady Maple for
Eater.
It published just yesterday. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Oh, that's fun. So Shady Maple, if you've never been, is sort of an overwhelming experience. It's this massive, massive building. You know, tour buses go there. And it's so big that they have the same buffet twice. So it's like a mirror image of itself.
Oh, wow.
And the food is sort of Lancaster County, Amish Mennonite classic food. So you get a lot of pickles, which delights me. You know, we'll always have pickled beets. There's a lot of meat, obviously. Vegetables cooked within an inch of their lives, or gratined. And really, they're not using the word gratin. It's a casserole. Mm-hmm. It's covered with cheese. They do my favorite thing to eat there, which I don't eat on a normal basis anyplace else, is mashed potatoes and pot roast. Oh my God. They do it so well.
What do you think makes it better than average?
Well, I think that when you're making pot roast on a grand scale and then sort of holding it, it just falls apart. Mm-hmm. So that's always delicious. And I think the secret to their mashed potatoes is that they must put copious amounts of butter and cream in. And when I make mashed potatoes, I know how much butter and cream is going in. So I hold back, and they're good, but they're not amazing. But when someone else is making them and you can't see how much is going in, you suspend your dietary restrictions and dive in.
Sure. Any other culinary highlights?
We went to Central Market in Lancaster, which is always fun. It's their sort of version of Reading Terminal Market on a smaller scale. I always want to eat just a Lancaster County sub. You know, it's different from a Philadelphia hoagie, but it's a sort of the same thing. It's basically a submarine sandwich. It's nothing special, but there's just something about it that's really good.
And,
I don't know.
But can you pinpoint what's different between like your typical hoagie?
The bread is a little bit softer. It's a little bit, I feel like it's probably an enriched bread. So maybe there's a little milk in the dough or something versus sort of the crustier bread roll you get in Philadelphia. Yeah. So it's this very tender bread. There's always lots of pickles you can get on it. They have a hot pepper spread that I always get.
Yum.
And it's good. It's good. And so those were some highlights. We did a little bit of shopping at Central Market, which is always fun. There's the Rooster Street Meat Company in Lancaster.
Oh, I've written about
them. We got some sausage from them and grilled it back of the cabin, which was really good. And I'm trying to think if there's any place else that was really memorable. I think that was it.
But it was pretty delicious.
It was mellow. We did a lot of grilling because the cabin had a grill, which is great for the city girl with no outside space. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, did things like got ice cream for lunch because that's what you do when you're on vacation. So it was fun.
True. Well, Dan and I went to this place in the Poconos called the Lodge at Woodlock.
Yeah.
Which is this luxurious spa property. It's about 3 hours away. And a friend of the show, Janaya Darlington, and her brother Andre were there for several days as guest chefs, and there were several cocktail events. And Woodlock, I guess, does this once a month where they bring in some type of culinary person. Carla Hall is a regular guest there, and it attracts a lot of food people for that reason. One thing that struck me as really kind of interesting was this sort of dual personality of the place.
Uh-huh.
Because on the one hand, there's like fitness classes and hikes, like starting early in the morning. there's spa treatments and a pool and the real wellness focus. And at the restaurant, there are definitely lots of healthy vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free options. Mm-hmm. And but then there's this other identity to the place that's a super culinary. And once a week, they do this chef-driven garden farm-to-table dinner where it's like five courses with wine. Wow. And it's like a beautiful wooden table in the right on the farm, so you can like see the lettuce greens growing that you're eating in your salad. And
God, that sounds amazing.
It was amazing and very indulgent. And like part of me, it sort of like brought out my own thinking about my own dual personality, where like on the one hand, I want to be this health nut and like I want to go jogging in the morning, but then I want to be doing like a cocktail hour and then a dinner with wine and then Tanaya led a port and cheese tasting one night.
Oh my God.
Right. So like those two things don't go together necessarily, but they do there. And you can, I guess, alternate. You can go one time and do the spa healthy thing and then go another time and do like the foodie indulgent thing.
Well, and you know, as Julia Child always said, moderation in all things, including moderation. So
yeah, I didn't jog or anything, but I did like look at those people a little bit envy. I was like, oh, I wish I wasn't bleary eyed from wine yesterday, and instead like trotting around the trails with my green juice. but still, it was highly recommended. It was really a fun place to be.
And how far is it from Philly?
3 hours, which is a bit long.
That is kind of a schlep,
but well worth it. It is also. There's also a lot of natural beauty out there. There was like a big lake, which, you know, I don't get to see many lakes. We went bird watching one day.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Jenny McGruther, blogger behind the site The Nourished Kitchen and author of the books The Nourished Kitchen and this new volume, Broth and Stock. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to talk good food.
Oh, it is. I love it. So thanks for coming on Local Mouthful today. First, I just want to start with a little bit of your background. How did you get started with traditional foods?
Well, I've always been interested in whole foods. When other little girls at 10 and 11 were playing with Barbie dolls, I was scouring my mother's cookbooks and trying to prepare extensive dinners to invite my friends over to partake in. So I've always been interested in traditional and whole foods in that respect, in cooking. It meant that during high school and college, I had veered toward vegetarianism and veganism because of I was really concerned about the ethics behind farming. Mm-hmm. And I became sick during that time period. And it was at the suggestion of my physician that I begin to incorporate more animal foods into my diet. I found, just by chance, a forum, I think it was on mothering.com, which still has forums now, it was a magazine then, that described the traditional foods movement. And it was fascinating to me because women on this forum were making their own yogurt. And that was revolutionary to me, that you could make your own yogurt. And that's how I stumbled into the traditional foods pathways. And it was a wonderful time. It really helped me to grow and to learn how to explore new techniques and new old methods of cooking and really explore that.
So your first book came out 2 years ago, and I feel like in looking through it, it's sort of a survey course in traditional cooking. You know, you've got all sorts of different recipes, whether it's stocking your pantry or, making dinner, whereas this book is much more focused. Do you feel like that was a reaction to the wide scope of the first book?
Yes, absolutely. Preparing Broth and Stock, it was a way for me to dive in with a more singular focus as opposed to, again, like a survey over all these different methods that are included within the traditional food pathways.
So tell me, what was this that became the thing that you were like, yes, now I'm going to dive deep and this is what I want to dive deep into?
Well, stocks and broths are really fascinating because you find them in every single culture. They're celebrated in every single culture. And they're truly peasant foods. They're inexpensive. They make use of foods and ingredients that would otherwise go to waste. And they have enormous value to the diet now that we've kind of lost. I explore this a little bit in Broth and Stock, but 150 years ago, everybody made their own broth and stock. And then as we began to understand more about food science, it allowed food scientists to begin to replace that traditional broth and stock that you would make at home from simmering, you know, bones and joints and trotters into little tiny cubes to sort of save home cooks all this time. And so we really completely deviated from this traditional food that has a lot of benefits. They've been using broth and stock as a healing food or as a nurturing food for generations upon generations. And so really exploring that aspect and recovering the wonderful varied flavors that we get in making homemade long simmered broths and stocks was important to me.
As much as I have dug deep into food preservation, I've never really run into the art of making that sort of dehydrated or concentrated sort of broth pucks. And for those of us who are just getting started doing this, do you have any tools that you recommend people stocking their kitchen with if they are walking down this path of beginning to make their own stocks and broths?
You know, there's certainly a level of intimidation that occurs when people begin to explore a new to them avenue of cooking. But I love to remind people that making stocks and broths is very, very simple. And if you can boil water, you can make a great stock. It's very, very simple. So all you need at the most basic is a pot and maybe a strainer. A good stock pot and a strainer, and that's all you need to just begin this path. So you have your nice stock pot, you drop in your bones and maybe some peppercorns and bay leaves to flavor, simmer it away, and then strain it. And that's all you need is a stock pot and a strainer. And if you want to, you know, explore other methods of making broths and stock, you might purchase an electric pressure cooker, or you might purchase a slow cooker. At its most basic, all you need is a good stock pot and a strainer.
Couldn't get any easier than that. So for someone who hasn't done it before, is there a particular recipe in the book that you recommend as a starting place?
I think the best recipe to really start with is the salt and pepper roasted chicken.
Okay.
And the, you know, long simmered chicken bone broth. Chicken broth is like comfort food. It's like pure comfort food, I think. And it's something that most of us really enjoy. And the salt and pepper roasted chicken is a very easy thing to make. So you roast up your chicken. And then, of course, your family enjoys this wonderful dish of roasted chicken. And then you take the bones and you turn them into a long simmered broth. It's incredibly easy. It's a great first recipe because you're guaranteed success in making it. And then you can veer into the other stocks and broths.
It's so funny. I often tell people if you can boil water, you can. So just one last question. How do you feel about how trendy bone broth has become in the last couple of years? You know, that you can buy it at like takeout windows and to-go cups in New York and things like that.
I find it very humorous, actually. I find it very funny. It's so easy to make at home, and it's so odd to me. And it's odd to me because, on one hand, through the popularity of Nourish Kitchen and what I've promoted on the site, I've had a hand in increasing visibility for broth and stock, certainly.
Yeah.
But I find it very odd that it is a trending food. This is back to basics, grandmother's old-fashioned cooking, and it's very strange to me that it would become so expensive, first of all, and trending in general. But on the other hand, I'm really, really thankful that it has gained more and more visibility, and I'm thankful that people are discovering broth and stock. You know, maybe it's a bone broth that they get in a cup at a New York eatery, or a cocktail that they try in, you know, a trendy restaurant in Los Angeles. But if it allows them to experience something, to enjoy it, and then to maybe take it home and start cooking whole foods from scratch, I think that's a wonderful thing. My only concern is that, as with anything that trends, if interest veers too far in one direction, it inevitably veers back in the other direction. And I really hope that we find a happy medium that encourages people to just cook whole foods from scratch at home.
Amen, sister. Well, thank you so much, Jenny, for coming on the show today. Again, our guest has been Jenny McGruther. She is the blogger at Nourished Kitchen, which is nourishedkitchen.com, and the author of the new book, Broth and Stock, from the Nourished Kitchen. Thanks again, Jenny.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to the farmer's market.
Okay.
What's your pick of the week?
So, sour cherries, although I have to add a caveat, which is that the sour cherry season in Philly is not going to be so good this year. Normally this time of year, I would be going gung-ho on sour cherries, but we had a late freeze in April, which decimated a lot of the local sour cherry crop. So we will still see them, but a number of farms that where you could do a U-pick on a sour cherry, they are closed this year. They're not going to open for any sort of cherry picking in general, let alone sour cherries. But if you can get your hands on some sour cherries, here are the things you should do with them.
Okay.
One, you should make some jam. And it doesn't have to be a fancy jam. It just, you pop the pits out. You can, and the easiest thing to do is do it by weight. No matter how many sour cherries you can get, you take them, you pit them, you weigh how much you have left. Then you use half as much sugar, a little lemon juice, cook it down until it's thick. It is the best jam ever. It's easy. It's good. It will be good on waffles, on toast, in yogurt, in oatmeal, with cheese. If you want to impress people, a dab of sour cherry jam on a cheese plate is really, really delicious.
I bet. I've actually never made jam with them. I've only made tarts, like not tarts, like crumbles, you know, pie type things.
Yeah. Well, and sour cherry, its other name is the pie cherry. So if you can get a lot and you want to make a pie rather than jam, a classic pie is going to be good, you know, just your favorite pie crust. A sour cherry likes like a lattice top. It doesn't necessarily want to be fully closed in. Or you can do that fun trick where you cut out rounds or shapes like stars from cookie dough and layer it on so that it has room for the steam to escape. But you get this fun, pretty, crust design. But, that's really delicious. If you are feeling like you only have maybe a pint of sour cherries and you want to do something really special and delicious with them, you can put them in a jar. You don't even have to take the pits out, and then cover them with bourbon and make a sour cherry bourbon infusion. That's going to be really, really good. And then you can later on add a little sugar and cook, you know, and just dissolve the sugar in and make it into a liqueur.
Can you make a cherry jam with just a pint of sour cherries?
No, that's not going to be enough. You're going to
What's the minimum?
Typically for sort of a regular sized pie, you're going to want at least...
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant a jam.
Oh, you can make any size batch of jam with any amount of berries you have or cherries. Yeah, because if you do it by weight and you're not going by any sort of standard recipe, you can, you know, so you have a pint of sour cherries, that's going to be about 12 ounces. Once you pit them, you'll probably have maybe 10 or 11 ounces. Mm-hmm. You weigh that out. Again, you zero it out. So you use half as much sugar and you put it into a frying pan, a little frying pan or a saucepan, and just cook it down.
It's still worth doing.
Sour cherries are going to be precious this year, but if you find them, I highly encourage you to get your hands on some, because they're just the best thing ever. Well, on that note, that's it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You can also sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.